MacCast, Tuesday, April 18th, 2017. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Well, looking at the notes for today, we don't have a ton of things to talk about. It's been a little light in Apple news as of late. We're kind of waiting on a bunch of things at this moment, waiting on maybe some new iPads, waiting to find out what Apple's going to do with next rounds of iMacs. And of course, we have all of the rumors and speculation going on about the iPhone 8. And we're going to be getting into a lot of that today. We're going to talk about the latest and greatest iPhone 8 stuff, although a lot of it is sort of rehashing a lot of the things that we've talked about already. We're going to take a look at Apple Watch and maybe some new health sensors that might be coming in there. Some updates to Apple TV, more specifically tvOS. Apple may be moving forward again with some of its Apple Car stuff. There's an interesting development this week in that. And also we've got more information on what we might expect in the future iMac updates that Apple has already told us about. We have all of that. And then we're going to get into some of your feedback. I'm going to comment on some things related to the iPad mini. I had asked you what you felt the relevance of the iPad mini was, if it was a device that Apple needed to keep around. I got some great feedback from you on that. I've got a tip and a couple tricks on how to use your Apple Watch with making phone calls, and then a question about whether or not to defrag your Mac. And if you don't know what defragging is, we'll get into that also. And then some comments on the state of podcasting at the moment, most specifically the AAC audio format. And then I have a cool little thing of the moment for you to round out the show. And that will be it. So we'll be kind of in and out. But before we get into it, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Bitbucket. Let's be honest. Your code is your world. You create it. You tweak it. You lovingly obsess over it every day. At least you do if you're like me. I'm working on code all the time. So picking the right repository management tool is really important. It's super important, in fact. And only the best will do for your code, right? Well, that's why the team at Atlassian created Bitbucket. Bitbucket is the Git solution for professional teams, helping over 5 million developers build with a purpose. And what it gives you is, any, whatever size your team is, it gives you private repositories with state-of-the-art features like the world's best pull request algorithms, built-in continuous delivery, and integrations with all of your favorite tools like Docker, AWS, and Azure. And because Bitbucket comes from Atlassian, it offers the best Jira integration available, giving your team everything you need to take your code from concept to customer. And I've used Bitbucket with several projects to help me keep my team and my code organized, secure, and on track. What I love about it is the ease of setting things up, the ability to easily integrate it with things like Amazon's Web Services. That was a key for my project because we had to deploy out to Amazon Web Services, and the integration Bitbucket offered made that process really simple. And it's nice to be able to, especially when you're working with remote teams, to have everybody kind of working out of the same source and tracking all of your code, and you can do all the branching that you need to do. It just works really great. And they also have some really unique features like branch permissions, which let you control who on your team can perform what actions on a branch type, or even on a branch pattern. So that's really great so that, you know, people don't step on each other. You can kind of control all of that. And Bitbucket is for the code. It takes us to Mars, it decodes the human genome, or drives your next car. So visit bitbucket.org/for the code. To start your free account. It'll let you use Bitbucket for small teams of up to 5 people, completely free, no credit card needed. So you can check it out. That's bitbucket.org/forthecode. Try Bitbucket today. What will your code do? And a big thanks to Bitbucket and Atlassian for their support of the MacCast. This week for the iPhone 8 iPhone edition rumors, it seems to be all about design speculation and schematic leaks. If you've been following along, there have been a number of different leaks from different sources claiming to show actual schematics of what the iPhone 8 designs are going to be. Now, the question becomes, is this the actual final design, or is this just more of Apple's various designs? And it's looking more like it's the latter. And probably the biggest question all of these things are trying to answer is, what's going to happen with that Touch ID sensor? You know, we've been talking about the fact that Apple really wants to be able to integrate it into the front glass. The whole concept of this 10th anniversary edition iPhone is a giant screen on the front of it with nothing else cluttering it up. There may be a small speaker hole, but pretty much everything, the front-facing cameras, everything's going to be hidden behind the glass, or at least that's what Apple wants to do. The problem is this has never been done before with the fingerprint sensor, and that, according to a lot of the reports, is giving Apple some trouble. So a lot of people are speculating, okay, what happens if Apple can't get this working? What does Apple have for a plan B, a plan C? And it's looking like plan B, according to many of the rumors, seems to be that Apple could move the Touch ID sensor to the back of the phone, kind of matching a lot of the Android designs that are out there. And I have mixed feelings about this. I don't know how you feel about it, but it seems like that's not the way to go. That's not really what you would want to do. I like having the fingerprint sensor right there on the bottom. Now, some have argued that it's a little bit awkward, actually, to kind of reach your thumb down to the bottom of the phone to actually do a scan. I've never found it all that awkward. To me, it seems like having it on the back would be a little bit more awkward. And I felt that way until my friend Dave Hamilton over at the Mac Observer pointed out that when you pick up your phone, most of us, and I've watched most people pick up and hold their phone, most of us support the back of the phone with your index finger. And for me, when I pick up my phone, my index finger just sort of naturally lands right where the Apple logo is on the back of the phone. So if the fingerprint sensor was there, that actually could be an okay motion. The only complaint I have about that is it's really convenient for unlocking with your index finger, but pretty much every other finger is going to be moot, or it's going to be a little bit more awkward to do that. I also think it makes it a little bit more awkward for using Apple Pay. With the thumbprint scanner on the front, it's much easier to do the whole tap to pay system because you sort of put the front edge of your phone down, right? And naturally, your thumb wants to land on that fingerprint sensor. So I think there's pluses and minuses to both. I think from a design perspective, not having to have an actual physical Touch ID sensor on the back of the phone is going to be better. So I'm really hoping that Apple will figure this out and they will be able to actually integrate the Touch ID sensor into the front of the glass. Now, related to that, I kind of feel like a better plan B, rather than going with a fingerprint sensor on the back, would be just to have a Touch ID sensor on the front of the phone. And if they're worried about the visual look of it, I still maintain, and this is, I'm the only one who's saying they could do this or speculating that they could do this, but we've heard this rumor of Apple doing a function bar, quote unquote function bar area at the bottom of the phone that would be sort of like, to me, it's the way it's been described, it sounds a lot like the touch bar that's on the new MacBook Pro, and that has a Touch ID sensor in it. It just happens to be square, and it's dark enough and integrated enough that it looks like it's part of the display. I think Apple could do the same sort of thing in the bottom center of the iPhone, and I think it could still really look great. But everybody else is saying it's either Apple's going to have it on the back, that, and this is all if the front one doesn't work, it'll be on the back, or they may not have it at all, which is just a rumor that I think is crazy, but the concept here is that they could go with a different kind of biometric sensor Apple's supposedly adding 3D facial recognition technology to the front-facing camera on the next iPhone, so they could just simply use that. In my mind, that's a big mistake. I don't think it's, for one, I don't think it's secure enough. It's going to be better than 2D facial recognition, but I just don't think it's as good, personally, from what I've read, as a fingerprint scanner. I'm willing to be proven wrong. If you're a biometrics expert, chime in. Let me know what you think about using just 3D facial recognition for unlocking the phone. But I also think it's just a little bit more awkward. I guess if it works at any angle, that's a little bit better. So some think they could go that route. And then the other route that many of the reports seem to be indicating is that Apple would just simply delay the launch of the iPhone 8. So we're supposed to get three models, updated versions of the iPhone 7, iPhone 7S Plus, and then this new iPhone 8 Edition model. And they could just wait longer to put that out while they figure out and get really what it is the yield rates and reliability of this front under glass sensor working. And I would prefer that they just do that. I, you know, not rush the phone out, actually get the device and design out that they want and go that route. I really think it's going to be extremely supply constrained, more so than any other iPhone that we've seen in the past at launch. So just prepare yourself for that. I'm already mentally preparing myself for that situation. It's not going to be good. So some of us may be waiting a while to get our new iPhone 8 once it's released. Some of the other things that we're hearing about with these schematics and these design specs is that it is looking more and more like it's going to have a vertically positioned dual camera sensor. So rather than being horizontal across the top of the phone, it's actually going to be oriented vertically so that when you put the phone into portrait mode to take a picture or to use the sensor, it will be more like stereoscopic vision. And the idea here, I think, is so that, again, the 3D camera system works a little bit better. And as a matter of fact, a lot of the designs are actually showing the LED flash right in the middle between the two camera sensors, even further creating that sense of stereo separation. And the idea is that that will be better for the 3D sensing technology, also for AR and VR applications. We've heard reports that Apple will eventually develop some sort of VR headset accessory for this iPhone that could connect with a smart connector that would be on the device as well. We've seen some designs showing a smart connector, and the idea would be that would dock into a VR headset accessory sometime in the future. It wouldn't be there available at launch, but sometime in the future it would be available. So vertically positioning the dual camera sensors makes a lot of sense in that context. Also, for the first time, we're hearing rumors that Apple may be looking at developing or using a dual lens system in the front-facing camera as well, and one that could potentially be integrated at least partially into the screen. Again, everything looking to be sort of seamless. And as far as what the final design is going to be, we still really don't know. We're hearing rumors of both curved glass and flat glass. Really, everything that I'm reading, I'm kind of falling in the camp where I think Apple's going to stick with the flat, what they call the 2.5D front glass. Think of the glass that you see on the current iPhone 7, iPhone 7 Plus, where just the edge is curved. The display is going to be almost completely bezel-less, so almost completely edge to edge. We're not really sure about this thickness of the phone. There's been contradictory rumors there. I think Apple's going to try and keep it about the same thinness of the current design, which would be 7.1 millimeters, although we did see a schematic leak this week that showed it almost as thick as an iPhone 4, 8.6 millimeters. And that seems like a direction Apple wouldn't want to move in. They've always pushed towards thinner and thinner or about the same thickness. So I don't know why they would make it thicker unless it's purely for battery reasons, which I think actually some people would welcome. A lot of people are welcome, you know, would say, I'll give up some of the thinness for more battery life. And I've heard that over and over again. Height and width wise, it's expected to be just slightly larger than the 4.7 inch iPhone, but they're going to cram in a larger than an iPhone 7S or 7 Plus display. So you're looking at a display probably about 5.8 inches at this point. So a nice big display on the front of that. And again, they're achieving that by going completely edge to edge. So it's going to be just all screen on the front. And I think it's going to look really gorgeous. And the reality on why we're hearing so many mixed reports on this is that there are several designs still into play. Apple hasn't nailed down or finalized any of the final specs. And so I think what we're seeing float around is a lot of different variations. And so you're getting little bits and pieces, but it's starting to form a whole picture. And I really think things like the edge-to-edge display, 5.8 inches, the sizing, I think that's coming into focus. I also think that the glass being the 2.5D, that seems to be the way it's going, and that horizontal lens system. The big variable at this point really seems to be the Touch ID sensor, and we're just going to have to wait and see what happens with that. As it gets closer to production and the launch date, we're getting closer to the point where Apple should be entering production on these, so it should start to settle out, and we'll kind of figure that out, I think, in the coming weeks to month or so. But that's kind of the latest on the iPhone 8. Another thing that we've been wondering about is what the next generation Apple Watch is going to look like. And so far, a lot of the Apple Watch rumors, if Apple does do an updated Apple Watch this year, we're sort of pointing to the fact that it wouldn't have many new features. Maybe adding some LTE autonomous functionality, that might come into play, but otherwise design remaining the same, a lot of the specs remaining the same. Well, this week, we actually got a report from CNBC that says Apple is actually working on a pretty killer new health feature for the Apple Watch. The question will become, is it something that we're going to see this year? Right now, it's not looking like it would happen this year, but maybe for a future Apple Watch design, maybe Apple Watch 4th edition. But their sources say that Apple has a small team of biomedical engineers, maybe around 30 or more, working out of a secret office space somewhere in Palo Alto, and they've been working there for quite a while. Apple Insider notes that back in 2013, Apple picked up a bunch of former employees from a biotech company called C8 MediSensors. They were closing up at the time, and that company actually specialized in non-invasive sensors capable of tracking substances in the body. And specifically, what Apple is supposedly working on right now is glucose monitoring for people who suffer from diabetes. They've been working and developing on this sensor, on a sensor that could constantly monitor blood sugar levels to better treat diabetes. And they've been doing it and working on this for at least 5 years. There's no timeline right now as far as when this would be included in a production watch, but the report does say they are far enough along to be conducting feasibility trials in clinical sites all around the Bay Area. So they're pretty far along at this point, and that's pretty impressive because a lot of different companies have tried to kind of crack this. And if this is something that Apple can pull off, this is going to be huge. A non-invasive way of monitoring blood sugar levels has kind of been this holy grail, and a lot of experts say it's really hard, if not impossible, to do. It's going to cost hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars to develop it. So if Apple is very, very serious about this, and it sounds like they have been, they could potentially pull this off, and that's pretty exciting. And since we first heard about the development of the Apple Watch, it had been rumored that Apple really wanted to pack in some additional health and fitness related capabilities and sensors. And so far, we've just seen the heart rate sensor, and they've also reportedly wanted to do things like oxygen levels and blood glucose monitoring. So they may be a few steps closer to actually achieving that goal, and that would be a big addition to a future model of the Apple Watch. So that was kind of an exciting report to hear about, and I hope it's something that they do ultimately achieve. According to the website The Verifier, I love that name, The Verifier, They say that tvOS 11 could bring a feature that a lot of us have been hoping would make its way to iOS, but it may land on tvOS first, and that is multi-user support. And this would be ideal at this point because, as you know, tvOS 10 added recently the TV app, and part of the TV app is designed to actually give you recommendations on what to watch based on what you've been watching. But for an Apple TV, you've got multiple members, say in a family or guests or relatives coming over, and everybody's using the same Apple TV. So they're not necessarily all that personalized recommendations. So just like Netflix and some other streaming apps have, it sounds like you're going to be able to set up multiple user accounts on your Apple TV, starting with tvOS 11. And that way your TV is going to be able to give you better recommendations on what to watch. You're also going to get personal synchronization of, say, your podcasts or your photos when you log into your account. And it looks like it's going to be based on your Apple ID. You'll be able to plug that in there. I'm assuming it's going to be integrated with iCloud. It's going to be kind of like fast user switching on your Mac. So you're going to be able to quickly switch between various accounts on the Apple TV, and everybody can get in and get at the things that they like to do on the Apple TV. I would imagine it'd be very handy also for launching your applications, right? You're going to be able to set up your folders the way you want. It's good all the way around. So that's kind of an exciting update to hear that might be coming in tvOS 11. And the good news is we shouldn't have to wait much longer to see this feature, because typically Apple is going to show off tvOS at WWDC, the Worldwide Developer Conference, in June. The report also mentions a couple other cool features that may be coming in tvOS 11. They say picture-in-picture may make its way there. And they also mention that Apple has plans to eventually add a live programming guide and at least some sort of subscription TV content. And of course, we've known for a while that that was an ambition that Apple has, that they want to bring some sort of subscription TV service and add more live features to Apple TV. It's not clear that any of these features would be there in tvOS 11, just that Apple is thinking about them and working on that for maybe a future option on the Apple TV. And one last comment on this multi-user feature maybe showing up in tvOS. I think a lot of us are really hoping for multi-user functionality also just in iOS. And I would imagine if Apple's going to bring it to tvOS, they could probably bring it to iOS as well. It would make sense to do it all at the same time because, again, the TV app also exists on your iOS devices. So you're probably going to want to be able to manage that and let people log into an iOS device and get at their personalized content there as well. And it would be great for families, a great for a lot of various applications, especially now that devices have more storage. You don't have to worry about that quite as much. So it is feasible that you could share an iPhone, or more specifically and more likely an iPad, between multiple members of a family. They could still not do it because I think Apple does in some ways see iOS devices really as a personal device, and you would tie it in again to your Apple ID or iCloud account, so you could just log in. But a lot of us have hope for multi-user on iOS, and it may be coming with the next set of updates. Let's keep our fingers crossed. And then another thing kind of on the content side, not specifically related to Apple TV, but maybe tying into some sort of subscription TV content or service, RBC analysts have once again thrown out this idea of Apple maybe acquiring Disney. This seems to pop up every once in a while, and they say that it would create, quote, unique opportunities. They're a little bit vague about what those opportunities are, beyond saying that they see the two companies are as leaders in their respective fields and that they don't have a lot of crossover between their businesses, and that merger, that combining of those forces could create some really great and unique things. The thought is that the merger would offer diversification for both companies. It could give Apple's services business a boost, and specifically Apple would suddenly have access to a very large content library that they could integrate with things like the Apple TV. I mean, you've got Disney, ABC, Marvel movies, Star Wars. Why was I going to say software? Star Wars, of course, which would be huge. That would be some great content to have access to with, say, an Apple subscription. And I think a lot of people would like that. The one question I have about this, though, is if they were to merge, they kind of create this media technology juggernaut. And my question would be, once they've done that, who else would really want to play ball with them? They might be locked to only that content. A lot of companies, I think, would be afraid to do deals. They're already afraid to do deals with Apple, which is why Apple has kind of struggled with this so far. So I'm not sure I see all of the ways that this would actually help Apple achieve a lot of their goals. And the actual likelihood of this deal going through, however interesting, is almost zero. And even RBC actually admits that in this piece. As a matter of fact, they do a little cost estimate analysis at what would it take if Apple wanted to actually purchase Disney outright. And they estimate the cost at more than $237 billion, which is, I think, right about at, or probably even a little more than Apple's current cash reserves. So I don't think Apple's going to want to deplete their entire cash reserve just to pick up Disney, even if it does have some quote-unquote unique opportunities. But what do you think? I mean, this idea of Apple acquiring a media company has been around and out for a long time now. I just don't see it as something that Apple's really going to move forward with. I think their whole position of what they're doing with creating original TV content and episodes and stuff with Apple Music, and kind of then expanding that maybe into some serialized stuff or maybe some original movies, kind of getting their toe wet a little bit and moving slowly, I think that's really the right strategy to do at this point. I don't see jumping in and spending a lot of cash on some big giant media company as really helping them, at least not in the, you know, in the short run. Maybe in the long run, I don't know. It's still hard to see even in the long run. But what do you think? Shoot me some feedback, mattcast@gmail.com. Apple Car rumors have been quiet, really, since Apple reportedly shifted the focus of their Apple Car project. They were supposedly building a car. Remember, we had all those rumors about all the things they were doing with Project Titan, and then they kind of shifted gears, revamped the project a little bit, and we stopped hearing about it. Well, now it's being reported that the California DMV has granted Apple a permit to actually test autonomous vehicles on public roads in the state of California. Now, one of the requirements to get a permit is they actually have to outline in specific detail the kinds of vehicles and tests that they want to do. So in getting that permit, a lot of that information came out this past week. Now, some had thought that this permit indicates that Apple at least does have some actual vehicles that they want to put out on the road and start testing. But Bloomberg did some digging with the permit that was filed, and because of the details, they found out that really what Apple is looking to do is start testing its self-driving car software platform. And that's what we know from the rumors was the shift. That was the shift in focus, that Apple moved from actually trying to build a car to building some sort of software hardware platform. And it looks like they're ready to start putting that to the test on the streets. They say that Apple will test their software in existing cars. And as a matter of fact, the permit covers three 2015 Lexus RX 450H SUVs and six drivers. And this is according to a DMV spokesperson. So that's what's going on there. Now, if and when Apple actually starts doing their testing, we're actually going to know about it. I'm assuming there's going to be a lot of people looking for Apple's cars out on the roads, and we'll probably get some spy shots there. But even if they don't do that, according to the DMV rules, Apple actually must file what's called a disengagement report once they've completed their testing. They have to do that with the DMV, and that outlines how many miles were covered with their self-driving vehicle. So there will be a report that would be publicly accessible, and I'm sure those details will come out. And you remember, Apple supposedly shifted focus from building this car to building an autonomous driving system. And that's all happening under the direction of Bob Mansfield. So this just looks like the next step in moving forward. And it's a pretty big one. Apple's actually ready to start putting some things on the street and really real world testing their hardware and their software. So it's going to be an exciting time for, you know, moving into the next phase of this project. And then finally in the news for this week, we're getting more information about the next iMac upgrade. The supply chain has begun to buzz about the new iMacs that Apple promised us by the end of the year. Remember when Apple made the announcement about what they're going to do with the Mac Pro? They also said, hey, by the way, we're also going to have some new iMacs this year, including a pro, you know, a pro-level iMac, something targeted at our iMac Pro customers, because we know there are a lot of pros actually using an iMac rather than a Mac Pro. And the chain claims that Apple is starting production on two new iMacs in the next month with a launch time frame sometime between August and October of this year. They say that Apple will grace us with a server grade model near the end of the year. So it's sounding like we're going to get an update early in the fall, and then before the end of the year, you're going to have this pro level server grade iMac. And the high-end iMac will supposedly feature Intel's unreleased Xeon E3 1285 V6 processor. It will have options for between 16 to 64 gigabytes of ECC RAM and support for up to a 2 terabyte NVMe Express PCIe flash storage. And they don't go into specifics on the GPU beyond saying it will have the latest discrete graphics processor, whether that will be something from NVIDIA or AMD, or maybe even some Apple custom silicon. I don't think it's going to be an Apple custom chip, at least not in the Mac quite yet. We heard the rumors that Apple may be working on GPUs for future versions of the iPhone. And I think eventually they'll get there on the Mac, but expect a really good discrete graphics card. The question will become, is Apple going to go with a desktop class, or are they going to stick with kind of the laptop class that they've typically used in the past? I'm guessing at least on the Pro model, they're going to go more into the desktop realm. I think this thing is going to be a screaming monster. And all models are expected to ship with USB-C ports and Thunderbolt 3 connectivity. So it's shaping up to be a pretty nice year for the iMac. It just looks like it's going to be happening a little bit later in the year. So if you've been kind of holding off waiting, you're going to have to wait until the fall. And what was cool about this report is these specs seem to match the report I told you about last week from Pikes Universum. That leak also said that Apple would deliver a brand new keyboard, which many of us, myself included, assume will be the touch bar version of the Apple Magic Keyboard. And that other report also said Apple would be delivering an 8K external display. And we do know that Apple said again at that Mac Pro meeting that they would be working on a new display as well. And an 8K Apple display, that would be pretty sweet. So again, it's going to be a great end of the year if you're in the market for a new desktop Mac. So stay tuned for all of that. And then one other really quick thing just to note, iMovie Numbers, Keynote, Pages, and GarageBand, both for Mac and iOS devices, have been updated on their respective app stores and now are completely free. And you might be going, weren't they free before? Well, yeah, they were free in the past if you had purchased a new Mac or an iOS device. And most of us have, so most of us have free access to the iWork suite and Keynote and Pages and Numbers and iMovie and GarageBand. But now free is just free. You don't have to have made a purchase. You can just get those apps. So if you had bought a secondhand Mac or a secondhand iOS device, you're going to be able to download the apps, get them for free. So that was that's a pretty nice little update to those applications. But with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Now I want to get into some of your feedback. One of the things that we were talking about when we got into some of the recent iPad rumors and potential iPad updates was this fact that the iPad mini has been scaled down to just a single model, just a single option. And I threw out the question of, do we think that Apple's going to keep the iPad mini around as they do the next iPad update? Is the mini kind of not long for this world? And I got a lot of feedback from iPad mini supporters, including supporters like Paul.
Hi, Adam. It's Paul here again from the UK. Just picking up on something that you mentioned, not on the most recent podcast, but the one before. And that was, I had sent a voicemail about the Siri activating maps and the screen going dark. You were absolutely right. I tried it again. I was always connected to power, but the screen does go blank. But just before the next junction that I have to turn, it does in fact come alive again. So you were quite right on that, and it seems to work pretty good. The other thing I just wanted to mention was you were talking about iPads and do we still need the iPad mini? Personally, I have an iMac that does all my big stuff, and I have a MacBook Air, which does all my writing stuff, which is the most fabulous laptop, carried around, wonderful. I don't do drawing, I don't do planning. If I did that sort of thing, then perhaps an iPad Pro with a pencil would be good. But if I'm typing, then I like a proper laptop. So that leaves the, where do the iPads come in? Well, personally, I would hate it if they stop making the iPad mini, because the iPad mini is like the old pocket notebook. It's just that sort of size, maybe slightly bigger, but it fits in a jacket pocket. It's there, you can make notes on it, you can take it with you very easily, and if you want to watch a film on it, it's just about big enough and it's easy to carry around. The same can be said of the bigger iPads, the iPad Air, but but it's not really pocketable. And the bigger phones, well, an iPhone 7 Plus is getting closer to the iPad mini, but it's more expensive because it's obviously got the phone element to it. And personally, like you, I have no desire to have a gigantic phone. I'm more than happy with my iPhone 7. So for me, the iPad mini is an absolute must. And I think for a lot of people out there, they would mourn the loss of that particular item. Great show, and thanks again. Bye.
Hey, Paul. I think there are a lot of people. Actually, I know there are a lot of people out there who wholeheartedly agree with you, because a lot of you echoed Paul's thoughts that form factor was the best one for a number of different applications. A lot of people wrote in to mention to me that, you know, reading books, watching movies is perfect on an iPad mini. It's that pocketable, take with you size. It doesn't take up a lot of space. It has great battery life, great for things like web surfing and answering emails, doing your social media, all those sorts of things. A lot of it having to do, I think, with content consumption and then light sorts of work. And Steven wrote in and said, yeah, he loves his. He likes to use it during his commute because it fits into a coat pocket very easily. And he pairs it with a Microsoft Universal Folding Keyboard. He sent me a link to that, so I'll link to it in the show notes at maccast.com. Little foldable Bluetooth keyboard, so you can take that out, and that fits in his pocket as well. So it all goes into a coat pocket when he wants to bring that out and do a little bit of light work during his commute. Makes it really, really easy. Another person who wrote in to say, hey, this is the model for me, the iPad mini, and I love it, is Chris, the host of the Amateur Traveler, Christensen. He calls himself, he says we're brothers from another mother, I guess is what I want to say. But he's host of the Amateur Traveler. If you haven't checked that out, it is a travel podcast. He does a bunch of travel stuff, does a lot of traveling, and he points out the iPad mini is perfect as a travel device. You know, if you're backpacking, if you're going to be traveling on a lot of planes or trains, it's very easy to carry around. And again, you can connect to Wi-Fi and coffee shops and hotspots and at the hotel. And he didn't mention this specifically, but I thought about this a little bit, and I thought another bonus would be the fact that you can, again, put it in a pocket, maybe carry it on your person so it's not in your bag, and that may be a little bit better for security. You can kind of keep it hidden away. People don't really know that maybe you have it, and that may be a way to keep your device a little bit safer when you're traveling as well. And I would say that most fans of the iPad mini also said that, you know what, I have a MacBook or a MacBook Pro or an iMac, desktop Mac, something that I use for heavy lifting other than the iPad. They also tended to prefer smaller phones. So they have a smaller phone, a Mac for doing heavier lifting kinds of tasks, and the iPad mini just sort of fits nicely there in the middle. So it's like this perfect combination, and I can totally understand that. So I think when it comes to device form factors, especially with iPads, it seems iPads are a very personal thing, and it really comes down to your workflow, your end use case, and what you want to do with it. So at the end of the day, I think the conclusion I'm coming to is Apple does need to have a bunch of different sizes to kind of fit the needs of the different types of users. Apple needs to have kind of this in-between device. And even if there is some overlap with something like the iPhone, you know, Plus models, they're different enough devices for different kinds of applications that you really do need to have both. So I think Apple did maybe the smart thing in choosing to limit the options and choices for these in-between devices just down to a few. And again, in the case of the iPad mini, we have currently just one model, the 128 gigabyte. You can get it in different colors, you can get it as a cellular or a Wi-Fi option, but beyond that, you have just the single model to choose from. That storage size is the nice right in the middle storage size, plenty for most people and not too small. So I think that's good, and I think they're going to keep that around for a while. The question just becomes, when they do put out new models, are they going to rev the processor? Are they going to play with the storage a little bit? And that remains to be seen. I think they're going to kind of stick with one model. I hope they do rev it. I hope we get like a fifth generation iPad mini, at least in terms of the internals, the processor, maybe upgraded camera systems. You know, it should get some of the benefits. It should be pulled along and get some of the benefits of the other iPad updates. I'm a little concerned that maybe they won't do that. They'll just kind of stick with the iPad mini 4 for a couple years and then eventually phase it out. But according to what I've been hearing from you and the feedback that I got, that doesn't seem like it would be a smart move on Apple's part. So hopefully they're listening to this. Hopefully they're listening to those of you, you know, those iPad mini fans out there, and continue to have and support that model well into the future. Have you ever been in a situation where your iPhone is ringing and you just can't quite get to it right away? Well, did you know if you're wearing an Apple Watch, you actually have a couple of different options on how you can actually handle and potentially take that call? A lot of us who have Apple Watch probably know that one of the options is you can just take the call on your Apple Watch. You can go all Dick Tracy style and simply raise your wrist, tap the little green answer button, and take the call right on the watch. Just kind of hold the watch up to your mouth. And I've done this on a number of occasions, specifically when I just can't get to my iPhone that might be buried in a pocket. If I'm wearing a big heavy coat, it's winter, and you just can't get to it. It's a great way to kind of take a call. And if you're having trouble hearing the caller, you just turn the digital crown, and that will raise the volume on the Apple Watch. There's also a mute button there. So if you need to mute it, you've got a lot of outside sounds because you're going to be on like a speakerphone situation. So it helps to be able to mute and unmute it pretty quickly right there from the Apple Watch. And when you're done, you just tap the little red hang up button, just like you were taking the call on speakerphone on your iPhone. But you never have to take your iPhone out of your pocket. So, or, you know, run across the room to grab it if it's on the table over there. So you can do it that way. Another thing that you may not know you can do, and I've done this quite often, is you can hand off the call. So you can take the call on the Apple Watch and then walk over to your iPhone and then just simply pick up the iPhone and switch over to it. Now, in order to get this to work, you need to make sure that it's set up in advance. So you're going to open the Apple Watch app. You're going to go into the general settings and just make sure the enable handoff option is turned on. Once you have that turned on, you can pick up the call on your Apple Watch. And then when you walk over to your phone and pick it up, when you can get to it, in the lower left corner of the screen, the lock screen, you'll see a little phone icon. You just swipe up on that icon. You'll have to unlock your phone, use Touch ID, or unlock your phone with the passcode. And then the phone app will actually automatically launch and just seamlessly transfer the call from your Apple Watch to your iPhone. And this is kind of my favorite way to pick up a call if I have my Apple Watch and I can't get right to my phone right away. I use this one actually quite frequently. So that's pretty cool. But you may be thinking, well, what if it's going to take me some time to actually get to the phone and I don't really want to take the call on my Apple Watch? What are my options there? Well, one that you might not know about that our friend Gary told me about is, did you know you can actually have your Apple Watch pick up the phone call and tell the caller that they need to hold on for a second. They need to wait for you. Yeah, you could actually do this. It's pretty cool. So what you do is, instead of tapping the little green answer button, simply swipe up on the watch, swipe up on that screen, or you can turn the digital crown, and a couple of other options will come up on the screen. And one of those is called Answer on iPhone. And if you tap that, you'll pick up the call, or your iPhone will pick up the call, but your caller will hear this. So that'll give you time to get to the phone, pick up the call, and then you can just do the handoff thing and pick up the call right on your phone. So that's a pretty cool little trick, and I had no idea that that was an option. Now, what if you're just literally like, I don't have time to talk, I don't want to run over to get my phone, but I want to let the caller know that I'm there? Well, once again, instead of tapping the green answer button, what you can do is you can swipe up on the Apple Watch screen or turn the digital crown. And in addition to the answer on phone button, you'll also see the send a message button. And when you tap on that, you can actually send them a text message or an iMessage. You can use the default smart replies, or you can use the scribble functionality. I guess you could also use Siri dictation as well, but in that case, you know, you might as well just have maybe picked up the call on speakerphone. I guess if you want to just send a text instead, you can do that. And that's a convenient way to just say, hey, I'm around. I'm going to call you back when I'm available. And you can actually customize those replies. A lot of people don't know you can do this. If you go into the Apple Watch app, go into the messages section under default replies, you can tap any one of those default replies and you can customize it. You can put it into your own voice. So, you know, if that's not typically how you would send a message, go ahead and personalize it, customize it. And if you want to remove a default reply or change the order that they come up in, you can simply tap the edit button on that same screen and you can move them around, you can delete them and change them. And so fully customize how you do that. But there's a couple ways that you can actually handle taking a call from your iPhone, all from your Apple Watch. I received an interesting email from Nick this week. Nick has a Mac Mini server that he uses for a media server, and he bought an external 3 terabyte hard drive, traditional spinning hard drive from OWC. He uses Plex and has all his media files actually on that drive. But unfortunately, after about 3 months, the drive crashed, he said, and he couldn't access the data on the drive. So now he's actually using a time capsule backup or time capsule with the data on it to serve as his Plex media server with that Mac Mini. But he used to be a PC user and he came up with a question. He wanted to know about the need for doing defragmenting or defragging the drive. And he was curious, you know, when he gets back up and running, is this something that he needs to worry about? Because it came up from time to time in the PC world that you need to defrag your hard drives. And he said he recently read that on the Mac, it's really not necessary, and said that the one exception he could find was in cases where maybe you have large files that are being accessed frequently, which would be exactly what he's doing, right? He's got a media server with large video files on it that he's accessing quite frequently while he's using Plex. So the question became, do I need, with Mac OS and a traditional, you know, hard drive with media files on it, do I need to worry about doing defragmenting or defragging the drive? And I think the place to start is, some of you might be going, well, what is defragging and why would you ever need to do it? I don't know what that is. Maybe you've heard the term before. Maybe you've never really kind of thought about what it is. And what it is fragmentation is something that can occur on a traditional spinning hard drive. It can also happen on SSDs, but really it's more related to traditional hard drives. And I'm going to explain all of this in a minute. So if you're screaming at your thing saying, oh, SSDs and defragging, that's a bad topic. We're going to get into that in a second. But just sticking with traditional spinning, you know, spinning disk hard drives, what can cause fragmentation, or what fragmentation is it comes about because of the nature of how the file formatting and the drive mechanics work. Basically, when you write data to the drive, so when you save an application or you download a file or you put a media file onto the hard drive, that information is written into little blocks on the drive. And when you first write a file to a completely blank drive, it fills up all of those blocks in order. I think typically from the inside of the platter, working their way outward. I think physically on the disk, that's how it works, if I'm getting this right. It might be the opposite direction. Whichever way is more efficient for reading. But then what happens is as you put data on the drive and then you delete that data, it frees up those blocks for new data to be written onto. So when you delete a file, it actually doesn't remove any data from the drive, which is why file recovery programs work. What actually it does is it marks those blocks where that file used to be, saying, okay, you can now write new data to this portion of the drive. And the drive always wants to write in the most efficient way. So when you start to put on new files, what it's going to try and do is fill up those empty or those available blocks. But those blocks may not be the same size. So you may delete a file, say that is 100 megabytes of space, but now you're trying to load on a 200 megabyte drive or file. So what could happen is it could write the first 100 megabytes in that space, and then it will break it up or fragment it and write the other 100 someplace else. And if it goes along and it then finds 25 more megabytes, it might do 25, and now it's got 75 left over that it's got to put somewhere, and it starts writing this to different areas of the drive, basically fragmenting the data on that drive. And the problem with that is, because of the mechanical nature of how that needs to get read, the drive head now has to fly back and forth across the different parts of the disk to read different parts of those files when you go back to access it. And that can cause slowdown on the drive. You can start to lose performance on the drive. And the more fragmented that drive becomes, the worse the performance is going to get. So defragmenting or defragging is a process where you use some software to analyze where all those file bits are and where the holes are. And then the defragging software will actually move those bits around and sort of reassemble them back into continuous pieces. And it will also consolidate the free space so that moving forward, as you start to add new files, it's able to add it in whole contiguous blocks into the free areas of the drive. And so that's defragging kind of in a nutshell. I'm kind of oversimplifying it, but you get the idea. Now, more and more, we have solid state drives and flash storage on our devices. So we're not really using traditional spinning hard drives with mechanical moving parts. And also, our operating systems and our file systems are actually getting smarter and better about how they manage our files. And they are avoiding or dealing with a lot of the issues that can come up with fragmentation. With solid state drives, with SSD drives, the controller actually does write the data in kind of this scattershot fashion all over multiple NAND chips and locations, but it uses algorithms that are in the controller that understand all of that. So it knows what it's doing. And for the operating system, this is pretty interesting because the operating system isn't set up normally to deal with that. It's set up with this idea of I've got all my data in blocks. The OS actually tricks itself into seeing that hard drive, that SSD, as a hard drive with like sectors and blocks. And even though the data is spread all over the drive by the controller, it can still kind of sort all of that out. And because there's no mechanical moving parts, it's really not an issue when it comes to performance. It doesn't really matter where those bits and pieces are, as long as the controller knows where they are and how to access them and how to deal with them, and the OS can handle it and get the information it needs. It just really doesn't impact performance. So fragmentation on an SSD for that reason isn't typically something you really need to worry about. SSDs also, and this is really important to be aware of, they have a limited number of write cycles. They have a lifespan to them in terms of the number of times that you can write to that drive. And actually running defragmentation software, because it moves bits and pieces around, it does a ton of writing. So actually running defragging on or defragmentation on an SSD drive actually in most cases is a pretty bad thing to do. You really don't want to do it. You're causing extra needless write cycles and wear and tear on your drive. So it's generally recommended that you don't ever defragment an SSD. There's also some things in the operating system that are going to make it so both on SSDs and traditional hard drives, you typically now don't have to do defragmenting. And Nick, that's what you were reading about or hearing about when you were finding articles that were saying you don't need to do defragmentation on the Mac. Basically, your OS has got your back, right? The Mac operating system handles a lot of the fragmentation issues, even on traditional hard drives. And it does it in a couple different ways. First of all, the current Mac file system, HFS Plus, it tries not to use the recently freed file space on the disk. It's going to actually go out and look for large free areas of the drive to fill first. And then once all of that's used up, and only then will it go back and start to use the little free space. And that's when the fragmentation kind of starts. So from the very beginning, as long as you have open free space on your hard drive, it's not totally full, it's going to kind of manage how it's writing to the drive. So that's step one. Step two is it dynamically gathers groups of small files and actually combines them into the larger areas of free space on your drive automatically. So it's doing kind of some active defragging. macOS also has something they call hot file adaptive clustering. And what this does is your operating system watches for frequently accessed files that are read-only. So say things like applications. Applications tend to be pretty large. You probably have a host of applications that you're accessing on a frequent basis. It's going to look for and find those, and it's going to move those files to special hot zones on your startup drive. And in that process, it also does a defragmenting of those files automatically. So if those files were fragmented, it's going to defrag them. It's going to move them to this special, like, quick access area of the drive. So that's pretty cool. And then finally, when you open a file, your Mac actually checks to see if that file has become highly fragmented. If it has more than 8 fragments, it's considered highly fragmented. And if it finds that to be the case, the operating system will actually automatically defragment that file if it can. So all of these things are going to be actively happening. And so, yes, there's kind of this active defragging going on. And if you're worried about your SSD, because I just, you know, said you don't need to do defragmenting, or you shouldn't do defragmenting, again, the operating system and the controllers on the drives that Apple uses, or the flash storage, that's managing all of that. It's doing it in a smart, intelligent way. So you really don't have to worry or think about this stuff. Now, in order for this automatic defragmentation to work, you do need to have a considerable amount or a moderate amount of free space always left on your drive, because it needs to be able to move files around and it has to have free space to do that. So the general rule is you want to try and leave at least 10% free space on your drive. If you're fuller than that, then you could start to see or start to get some fragmenting going on, even with all of these automated processes. And that's just because literally the operating system doesn't have the space to do its job. So you always want to make sure that you have about 10% free space for optimal performance. It's just a good general rule. So make sure that you're doing that. And so you might be asking, what about this exception of, you know, these really large files? If you're reading, writing, and deleting a lot of large files from your drive, it could technically lead to more fragmentation. And this typically happens to people who are like audio editors or video editors, where you're putting a lot of files on and you're taking them off, you're deleting them, you're moving them around, and there's a lot of changing going on with large files, right? Because you have this large file and it can't fit into these little holes and spaces that get created when you're deleting other kinds of files. And that's where the fragmentation starts to come into play. So a lot of times what you'll see is video editors or audio editors, they'll actually have a second external drive that's just a project drive. And what they do is when they're working on an active project, they first start by completely erasing that hard drive and then moving all of their project files onto it. And that's basically a way of defragmenting, because when you first write to a drive, remember, a clean, brand new drive, it's going to put everything on there in a nice, neat order. And then they can work on their project. They'll get a little, you know, a little fragmentation going on as they're working, but it's not going to be nearly as extreme as if they're working with a really old drive that's been being written to it and deleted from quite frequently. So that's one way to handle that. And actually, if you are looking at wanting to defragment your internal hard drive, erasing and doing a restore from backup is probably one of the best ways to actually defragment your drive. So just make sure you have good full backups. And, you know, this is why every couple years I like to do a full clean install of my operating system. It just kind of cleans up everything on the drive. So actually, in your case, Nick, since unfortunately you had a hard drive crash, and I'm assuming you're getting that replaced or repaired from OWC, when you get the new drive back in, that's going to be a clean drive. So when you move all of your media files back onto that drive, they should go on there completely defragmented. You shouldn't have a lot of fragmentation, and you likely wouldn't have had fragmentation in the first place, because I'm assuming that's how you set up the drive initially. So, and you're not probably going in there and deleting your media files, since these are all your movies. You're not deleting them and putting new ones on. You're just adding new ones in. And as you add new ones in, those are going to go into the free space that should be all in, you know, a giant block on the drive. So you should be okay there. But if you do want to do defragmentation, you know, a lot of people probably are aware that Apple does not include a tool for it. Again, because in Apple's mind, the operating system is managing this for you. You really shouldn't have to do defragging. But if you have a use case scenario after listening to all this, you're like, yeah, I still think I want to defragment my drive. And remember, don't defragment your SSDs, only your traditional spinning hard drives. There are some third-party tools that you can get, like Drive Genius or iDefrag. I'll have links to both of them in the show notes at maccast.com. And those are some good applications for doing defragmentation. But again, in all but a few extreme cases, you really don't need to defrag on the Mac. And it could be even bad for your drive if you're using an SSD. So that's kind of my thoughts on defragmenting on the Mac. And I'm sure some of you probably have some thoughts and opinions on this. I welcome your comments and feedback. Of course, as always, send those to me, maccast@gmail.com. Now, real quickly, I want to bring up something because a couple of you have asked me about this this week. I received a couple of emails. This is a podcast relating, a podcast related thing. I know a number of you listen to my podcast using the great podcast application Overcast, developed by Marco Armont. And I started getting a lot of emails this week asking if I had removed chapters or the enhanced features of my podcast. And I was a little bit puzzled by it because, no, I haven't. I still put chapters in. I still do an enhanced podcast. And I'll explain what an enhanced podcast is here in a moment. But yeah, a number of you were noticing that you weren't getting the chapters in Overcast. And so what an enhanced podcast is if you're listening to this podcast in iTunes or in the podcast app, there is a chapters menu. And as you're listening, you can actually jump forward from section to section using the chapters. In iTunes, there's actually a chapters menu and you can pull it down. I think in the podcast app, there is a little button. It looks like a list. And if you tap on that, you will get the list of chapters. And also, in addition to chapters, I will typically sometimes put in links. So you'll see a link come up on your screen. And even in some cases, like when I'm reading the ads, you'll see a logo or the album art will actually change. And that's the enhanced features. And it's something that Apple added into the AAC audio format that they support. And it's supported in iTunes and the podcast app from Apple, and also some third-party apps like Overcast or Downcast and things like that. There's also the ability to do what they call chapterized MP3s, and a lot of these apps have support for that as well. So what happened with Overcast? What's going on? Why are some of you not seeing chapters suddenly in Overcast? Well, I reached out, I contacted Marco on Twitter, and it turns out, unfortunately, the latest update, version update of Overcast, in that Marco had to temporarily remove support for AAC chapters. And the reason he had to do that was the chapter parser, Apple's parser for extracting that chapter data, was actually causing a lot of crashes in certain conditions under iOS 10.3. So in iOS 10.3, it was causing problems for Marco's application, and it's all Apple's stuff. This is not stuff that Marco did. It's Apple's got issues with their chapter parser and iOS 10.3. And I wish I could say this is surprising to me, but it's not. More on that here in a second. But I mean, Marco's even going so far as to be considering writing his own parser, which is 100% undocumented. I mean, it would be a Herculean task, but writing his own parser just to get that feature back up and working. But the thing is that MP3 chapters are already here, and those work fine in standard MP3 files. The problem is that Apple doesn't support MP3 chapters in any of their applications. It's not supported in iTunes, and it's not supported in the podcast app. So what's going on is we've got this format disconnect. We've got AAC chapters in, the two big applications from Apple, and then you have everybody else in the podcast community kind of moving toward and supporting MP3 chapters. And I actually have an MP3 version of the MacCast feed. It's just not in iTunes. So if you subscribe through iTunes or through the podcast app or through actually a lot of the podcast apps out there, what you're getting is you're getting the AAC version of the MacCast. In order to get the MP3 version, you'd actually have to subscribe manually. MacCast.com/RSS.XML is the URL. There's actually a link to it at the top of the page at MacCast.com. If you don't click the iTunes link, if you just click the other podcast link, you'll get the RSS feed for the MP3 version of the MacCast. And I have been doing MP3 chapters for a while now. So you can switch over to that, especially if you're in Overcast. You probably want to switch over to that version. You're going to get all the same chapters and stuff. It's just that you'll be getting an MP3 audio file instead of an AAC audio file. So I wanted to point this out. I also wanted to say that, Apple's support for AAC, their own format, in my mind, it feels like they're completely abandoning it. So again, that's why it doesn't surprise me that it broke with iOS 10.3, that the chapter parser broke, because I don't think Apple's paying attention to it. They removed the chapter functionality from GarageBand recently. They haven't brought that back. They haven't officially said they're not supporting AAC chapters anymore, but just the lack of attention to it seems to indicate that. And there are very few of us that are actually doing chapterized AAC files. I know Dave Hamilton does it. I think a few other podcasters out there do it, but we are few and far between. So I think we're at a point now where Apple either needs to let the AAC chapterized format completely go and start supporting MP3 chapters, or if they're not going to do that, then they need to come back and fully support AAC in a really big way, especially with supporting developers who want to integrate it with their apps. They need to have better documentation, better APIs. They can't be doing things like breaking the chapter parser in 10.3. I like the AAC format. The files are smaller. I think they sound better at the same bit rates. But if we need to move to MP3, let's just move to MP3. It's more universally supported. It's cross-platform. It would probably be the better way to go. So I don't know what's going to happen with the state of chapterized podcasts, but I think it's probably time to move to MP3. I'll continue to support both for a while longer, but I'm just letting you know right now, we're kind of at a crossroads, and I may get to the point within the next year where I just kill the AAC and we go purely with MP3. That would be a hard thing to do because, again, it's not supported in iTunes or in Apple's podcast app, but it may be the path that we're moving toward. What are your thoughts on this? Your podcast listeners, you know, every time I've asked about this, people seem to love and value the chapters that I put into the MacCast. I've thought about just making it go away because, again, a lot of people don't do chapters at all. So if those were gone, I'm assuming you would be disappointed. But if you don't care, let me know. If you care, let me know. I'd love to hear from you. MacCast@gmail.com. And then one other quick thing for you in this episode of the MacCast, my thing of the moment for this week, it's actually a website, one that's a great website all around, but I'm going to point you to a specific portion of this website, and that is the Internet Archive, archive.org. This week, they threw up a section that is a Mac software library, a classic Mac software library. They actually have 45 classic Mac titles that you can actually go on the website and run in a Mac emulator, a Mac classic emulator that runs in JavaScript right inside your browser. It'll even work on your iPhone or your iPad, although you don't have mouse support, so you can't really click around the screen, but you can try it out. They have System 7.0.1. They have System 6.0.8. They have Mac Paint. Dark Castle, remember that game? That's an awesome game on classic Macs. Load Runner, Microsoft Flight Simulator, Microsoft Basic. I played around with Smooth Talker. There's a whole bunch more. 45 classic titles on there, and you can run them right inside your browser. You can also download the apps. They have the disk image files, the .dsk files that you can download from the website. So they're preserving and saving. This is kind of Internet Archive's mission. Preserving and saving our digital history. And these apps are definitely part of that digital history. And a lot of them are going to get lost to the world because they're out there on floppies somewhere. You know, finding copies can be difficult. So it's nice to have them all in one place and to be able to emulate them right there online. So you can check that out. archive.org/details/software-library_Mac. I'll have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com. But check out the Internet Archive Mac Software Library. And with that, that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I'd like to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disk Label, also Text Expander for iPhone and iPad, along with PDF Pen for iOS and PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can get more information, details on all of Smile's great applications by going to smilesoftware.com/MacCast. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at CacheFly.com, and all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media, and they are at BackbeatMedia.com. If you have a comment for me, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, you're always welcome to send me emails or audio comments to MacCast@gmail.com. Or you can call in on the listener hotline, that telephone number, 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9. You can leave a voicemail message there. Just be aware, voicemail messages are limited to 3 minutes on the hotline. So if you'd prefer another way, it's probably, you know, and you have something more that's going to take longer than 3 minutes to say, you probably want to send that as an audio comment. Just record something in GarageBand or record something on your iOS device and shoot that to me in an email. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talk about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And if you're on social media and you'd like to follow me between shows, you can follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/maccast. You can also check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/themaccast, or check out the MacCast Google Plus community. That's at google.com/plusMacCast. But that is going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.